Hello, coffee makers, not coffee takers. He is Dr. Joseph J. Burt Miller Jr., and I am the master of cyber farms, Alfredo B. Nash Jr. We are the hosts of the Cyber Coffee Hour. We are two cyber experts from Mount Vernon, New York, sharing with you our experiences in this field and also the experience of others so we can learn, elevate, and ultimately realize that we belong in this space. The views, opinions, and thoughts are those of the Cyber Coffee Hour podcast and not those of our employers, personal, or professional relationships. Today, we are going to discuss the interdependence of technology and social work and the vulnerability of social works to cybercrime. To help us break it down is a PhD candidate and licensed master social worker, Tony Danae Owens. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you all?
Good.
So our guest, Tony Danae Owens, was born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in Social Sciences with a minor in American Ethnic Studies and a Bachelor of Science in Social Work from Kansas State University, where she serves on the K-State Social Work Community Advisory Committee. Tony earned her Master of Social Work degree from Park University, where she was initiated into the Phi Alpha Social Work Honor Society. Tony is a PhD candidate in the Human and Community Development Program at West Virginia University. She also serves as a founding advisory member for WVU's Faculty Justice Network and was selected to be a part of the inaugural cohort of the Engaged Scholar Institute at WVU in 2023. Tony is a member of the National Branch of the NAACP, American Civil Liberties Union, and Urban League Young Professionals of Middle Tennessee, and has been an active member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated for over 15 years. As one of three 2023 through 2024 diversity dissertation fellows at Middle State University, Tony teaches cultural diversity in the Department of Social Work while concurrently completing her dissertation. She is a licensed master social worker with credentials to practice in Kansas, Georgia, and Tennessee. Tony has personally and professionally committed herself to advocating for holistic wellness, social justice, and equitable opportunities for all. Tony, welcome to the Cyber Coffee Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me all the way from Middle Tennessee State University.
You know what makes this a really special episode? Because this is the anniversary episode of the Cyber Coffee Hour when these two guys from Mount Vernon, and I'm talking about myself and Alfredo, we somehow found each other after high school, and really through a mutual friend. I don't think either one of us can really take the credit. It's really a mutual friend. He was the glue. So, then after that, we just went to work, and I think we just. We put in that vision. We had that vision of what we want to do. We had discussions, of course, and we just went to work, and here it is. So I'm very proud of the work we've done to this point, and I'm very motivated and hopeful for the future of what we can do and the work, the people that we can impact, and also just looking at the full landscape of cybersecurity. We do want to make when it comes to where they're making a change, especially when we talk about those who are underrepresented within this field. We want to make sure those people do get equal opportunity, that their voices are heard, and to just letting the world know that, we're in this thing too. So, Bob Fredzo, man, just share your thoughts on an anniversary.
Hey, we out here now. It was a hard year. I'm giving everyone credit that does this. Anybody that wants to start a podcast, do it. It was amazing and motivating, like you said, and super humbling, putting up a platform. We're still work in progress. We're still out here now. But the most important thing is we did it and we're here. So I'm super hyped. I'm super motivated. And it's hard to believe a year went by. We're only just getting started, right? We got so much more that we want to bring, so much more guests, so many more platform enhancements. So there's a lot. There's a lot
absolutely.
About it. Reconnecting with somebody where I thought we were by ourselves. Like I said, we said it in our first two episodes, our two beta rounds. It was a breath of fresh air to realize we weren't in this industry by ourselves. And somebody from our neck of woods just wants to do the same thing and be on the same project and find others that want to be on the show and in cybersecurity or not even interested in cybersecurity, right? So it's great that we did it and we got it off the ground and we made it a year. There's only many more to come.
Absolutely, man. Great. Great. I mean, and Tony, I mean, you chose of all episodes to come on the anniversary episode. You know what I mean?
I know, right? This is awesome. I mean, I think, well, you know, we talked about this before, how, you know, I make history. And so this is what we do. And so I really feel like it's fitting because it's Social Work Month. And so I think that, you know, we were all talking about, you know, some of the things or looking back on like where we, how far we've come in the last year. And like things have changed immensely, like I think in both of our fields in the last year. Mm-hmm. And so talking about this overlap during Social Work Month, I think is very fitting. Yeah. And I just feel like we have, you know, great banter. So why not have a lively anniversary episode, you know? So I think it's great. And congratulations to you both.
Thank you. All right. So as our friends mentioned, the two articles we are going to discuss. So we'll start with the first one. And that is, Actually, you know what? I'm going to change up a little bit, if you don't mind. So the first one will be
your anniversary.
The first one is titled Privacy Breaches: Why Social Workers Are Vulnerable and What You Can Do About It. So the author of this is from ProLink. I guess they have their own blog section, so they don't really have a person to attribute it to, but the company ProLink, it was dated back in March 5th, 2022. So I'll read a quick excerpt from the article and then we'll discuss it. So in a digital age, more and more healthcare services are moving online, from electronic patient logs to virtual counseling, and an increase in array of medical devices and equipment. Technology has become more critical than ever in providing care. As a result, cybercrime against healthcare organizations has surged in the last few years, particularly with the transition to virtual care full-time during the pandemic. With an ever-expanding database of personal health information, or PHI, at stake, it's a good idea for social workers to refresh their responsibilities and their risks regarding data security. And then from there, we talk about, like, you know, what's a privacy breach, the effects, why are social workers vulnerable, and just how you can keep all that data, and also the practice. So first, before we go into it, and Tony, I'll go to you. Like, you know, just hearing this, like, what are some of the, when you're practicing within your field, how much is cybersecurity, I guess, stays at the forefront of your mind?
It's definitely there because we're always thinking about how we can protect the clients. And I think that, you know, this specific article talks about health information, but there's a lot of work that we do that have nothing to do with health information. It's just personal information that people want to keep private. And so there's a lot of law protections around health information in particular, but you may see there may be a small gap with just things that are just sensitive information. And it's just very subjective. And so you have to be able to lean on your social work ethics to say, is this something that my client would want the public to know? And if not, you protect it with the same amount of privacy that you would their health information. And so though I appreciate the illumination of, you know, PHI, like, you know, and understanding that it's important to think about, but it's those in between things that you really have to pay close attention to, things that are very private that may not be considered to be health, but still something that you have to realize that we're dealing with people in their personal lives more often than not on their best days. And there's just some things that you want to be able to just keep close to the heart, you know, for your clients, and to be able to bear that space for them, give them the privacy that they deserve. And so those are the things that really come to mind when you're practicing, more than just specifically health information.
Absolutely. And our friends, as we dig into this, tell the people or explain to people what is a privacy breach. I think that will help lay the foundation
talking
forward about it. No, Alfredo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm on it. So a privacy breach is something where, let's say, an illegitimate actor gets unauthorized access to that sensitive information that Tony was saying we should protect. And usually an organization would particularly try to put a safeguard or mechanism in place to protect it, but it's weak. Right. Mm-hmm. So that weak protection, that weak safeguard is bypassed. And then that sensitive information Tony was talking about, not just the PHI, the things and circumstances that someone's gone through, it occurs in a privacy breach. Right. So case study work, medical treatment, facilitation, things that the organizations and institutes were supposed to protect got bypassed or compromised. And now it's a double hit. You get the health information, but you get those circumstances also in the privacy.
So
no with, problem.
No, I think, I mean, but that's part of what we do. We do the education piece as well. So I think that's great. But no, but like, so this article breaks it down into five different categories as to why social workers are a prime target for cyber criminals. So, so we have confidential data. Number two is access. Three, virtual care. Four, operational disruptions. And the fifth one is human error. So let's just break this down just a little bit. So we're looking at confidential data. So that will contain or relate to like health records. You know, health records are a big target, you know, as far as for cyber criminals. That leads to social engineering. And social engineering, you know, someone, you know, try to pose as something as, or try to manipulate the person who has, who is in charge of that data, try to manipulate and get that data out of, you know, from them, or get that access from them. Identity fraud, fake insurance claims, and you know, that's big money. People try to exploit and find ways to, like I said, beat the system in that sense. Even small practices possess a wealth of sensitive information, like names, birth dates, addresses, and banking details. And I think Tony, you kind of go into it where it's not necessarily, maybe PHI so much, but you know, just information you just don't want to have out there. But this information here, I think that's big. Like you don't want your address out there, especially banking. That's a big deal. Who wants their banking, you know, and route number out there for everyone to just have free will over?
Well, to Tony's point too, I think even as a cybersecurity professional, I think the virtual care is higher stakes than that too, right? I don't want people knowing my treatment plan, right? That virtual care that the social worker has access to, whether they get social engineered or the organization has an operational disruption, that exposes, you know, the treatment plan and the social worker. So yeah. I think that's higher than the banks, in my opinion, because now it's a double dip, right? Now I know the insurance you use. I know your care provider. I know your treatment plan, and I can expose it. You got to be a pretty vile person to go after that too. So, you know.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of things that can be said about confidential data. I think that we often look at it from the perspective of protecting the client, but social workers also have to protect themselves. And right. So you might be able to give me some advice on this. One of the things that we deal with a lot as practitioners and, you know, clinicians and all the social workers out that are practicing now is our clients looking us up.
Docent.
And so like, and as a professor as well, that's the number one thing that students do. They type in your name and they look you up and they try to, I would love to have a conversation about how we can protect ourselves as providers and as educators and social workers that are practicing, because our information, there's so much information about ourselves that is public. And there's so much information that about ourselves, like that's out there in the world. And a lot of times people use social media to be able to promote their businesses, especially if they're in private practice. But that allows a window in, you know? And so I feel like you almost have to be exposed in a way that you have to craft what is out there, because you know it's going to happen. You know they're going to look you up. You know they're going to Google you. Unfortunately, when addresses are coming up, phone numbers, family members' names, you know, are coming up, you feel very exposed when you're in that space. And so for a client to come in and say, oh yeah, I saw that you used to live in that neighborhood. I'm from that neighborhood.
Oh,
it's
man.
Like, you know,
that,
like
I don't feel good.
Yeah, it not doesn't at all. Feel good, but absolutely not.
But no. We also are not educated in how do we protect ourselves. And so I have students trying to add me on social media and I'm just kind of like, you know, like I don't want my students on the social media, like with my grandmother commenting on my pictures from, you know, from a wedding, you know? So,
right,
but
right.
We also are like, how do we talk about those things? And so that confidential information is, it's not information that is necessarily like, you know, top class secret, but it's just information that I don't want everyone, especially a client or a student, to have access to.
Shouldn't be for public consumption.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that shouldn't we put be. That back on the organization. There are safeguards for that. There are obfuscation techniques. We probably have to do a whole the episode on that. And then there's also common courtesy and professional courtesy of how to protect you as a social worker, right? So that's not on anyone as a social worker. That would be what an actor will look at as an operational disruption. Let me take out whatever they're using to protect the caseworker's information and expose it. So that's on the organization to kind of step their game up, let's be real, and obfuscate that on your behalf on whatever application you're using, right? So there's one side of the house that says, hey, we administrative work for our employee is separate from the client's access to that employee, right? They'll see just first name, no last name, right? They'll see no street right. address. They'll see no city, right? That's on the organization to start doing that additional homework themselves and protecting your information as a social worker, right? And there's means to do that in applications, but there's also a physical, like private and guest investigative work that needs to be done to say these persons cannot be in the same neighborhood, these persons cannot be from the same background, and that we don't pair those clients up, you know, accordingly. So there are ways to your point, there are ways in applications to protect you, but it's also physical, what we call operational security, that needs to be stood up as well. So that would be my recommendation, not for the social worker, but for organizations that host you guys or employ you guys.
Right. Well, as social workers, we're out in the community. And so like we're working person to person sometimes. And so a lot of times. And also to be able to ensure that your social worker is their license is what it's supposed to be, up to date and in good standing, that your clinician actually is a clinician, and you know, that they have, you know, all the credentials necessary, your full name like is out there. And so like when you're finding a therapist on Psychology Today, their full information is there, like, and present. Like, that is how a lot of people, you know, Psychology Today, if you're a therapist, like, usually you have a Psychology Today profile. And so, like, that is what is there. And also our license numbers. But the thing is that that's there for a reason. It's for accountability purposes. If something happens, and I think we had previously discussed, like, you know, in another space about licensure and that process of how we're held accountable and how we have to do continuing education hours to make sure our licenses are up to date, how we can only see, you know, clinically, you can only see clients that you're licensed in that state. And so, you know, I'm licensed in Kansas, I'm licensed in Georgia, and I'm licensed in Tennessee. But the thing is that you would have to be able to verify that somehow. And so you would need, you know, your first and last, you would need a license number. So if something did happen, that you would be able to take that license number and make a complaint to that board of social work and say, this social worker, this is their license number, this is what happened. And so if I went to go get, you know, not me, because I would never, you know, have any kind of disciplinary action, but someone that would do something that would require it to be reported, then, you know, when you go to get a license in another state, the first thing they do is say, we need a license verification from all the other states that you are licensed in. They check and see, is there any disciplinary action in any other states against your license? And so our accountability measures require us to be such, you know, so exposed and to the point where our full names and our license numbers and everything is out there to hold us accountable. And so that's why anyone, which I'm sure someone is going to Google me, you know, it will Google me and be able to see, you know, whatever it pulls up. And so I would love to be able to remove a lot of those different things, because it does, you know, pull up things that, you know, luckily there's nothing out there that I'm not proud of, but there's also things that are like, that's a little too close, you know? Right. So that is something that I feel like we should talk about more in our field.
We definitely, that's a problem even trying to protect someone like you, because you need that to do your everyday job. Someone's backtracking on what you need to do your job properly and benevolently. But no one ever assumes that that information can be used maliciously.
Exactly.
So that's the part that is very difficult for a cyber professional, for sure.
Exactly.
I'll just say a traditional cyber professional.
So along that same vein, so going back to the article, it states that healthcare professionals suffer the greatest damages following a privacy breach. According to IBM's 2021 Cost of a Data Breach report, healthcare has taken the top spot for breach costs for the 11th year in a row. Average breach costs are at $9.23 million per event, a 29.5% rise from $7.13 million in 2020. Now, I'm sure these numbers will be different, because given this was article from last year, but I would suspect these numbers are going to be more of an upward trend. I mean, our friends, we saw an article for United Healthcare that data's got a breach.
We still counting up the pennies on, right?
We don't know. And that's not the first time they got hit.
Right.
This ain't the first time they got hit again.
Right. It's like double dipping, triple dipping, because they know it's lucrative to these magnitudes of millions, right? Even billions now. I mean, United's not small, right? And United services other networks. Right, all the professionals, right? So when they go down in cascades, we should probably do an episode on that one too. But it's not without sophistication to know to keep going after these particular institutions, because one, they're going to pay because they service a greater need of victimology. Let's just say, sorry to say it that way, but they know that there's an urgency to support the patients, right? So they can't be down.
So they can't be. Right. You know, lollygagging and be like,
they can't do a DR even if you're the quickest person to restore their site. They don't have an hour to 4 hours to bring it back up online. And that's the sad part. That just off the top of my brain. Right. The other side of it is the magnitude of which they have access to the community and people. Right. They know these adversaries know that is an urgency to service the people, prescriptions, social workers, case notes, dispatching patients, inpatient, outpatient. Right. They know that that's a round the clock thing. And so that pressure is there. Right. That pressure is there on the medical provider to just pay, which is sad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also social ramifications to these breaches. And so when you have a therapist that is seeing someone, and they are apprehensive a lot of times, especially early before you're building rapport, about what they're saying and how they're saying, and because they understand that this needs to be documented, you know, for us to be able to show that there's progress and movement, that we have to make sure that things are documented. But you see, they're choosing their words carefully because they're wondering, like, is there a chance that this could be, you know, something that could come back around again, or something that could be leaked, and it's unfortunate when these things happen. It does cause people to pause and think again whether or not they want to enter these spaces where someone is documenting their innermost private thoughts. And so I will say there's definitely some hesitation, and especially when these things are publicized, as they should be, to know that these things are happening. But it does, you know, cross the mind of someone who is coming into a space hoping that this conversation will only stay within the walls.
No, and I think you bring up a great point, Tony, because the article only touches on, when we talk about like the aftermath of a breach, they talk about extensive remediation efforts, legal counsel fees, defense costs, data restoration, public relations support. So I think that's kind of what you're touching on there, that public relations support and credit monitoring. But no, I think that's very true, because if you're already having a hard time even making a call to say, all right, I'm going to call the therapist, and, you know, maybe you were, you know, hemming and hawing over a couple of months, like, I don't know if I should talk to someone. Finally decided to do it. And typically that first session is not, you know, More than not, you're not going to be spilling everything. It's going to take some time to build that rapport.
Sometimes it just depends.
No, I agree. I'm sure, and that's why I say, like, you know, for some, I think more often than not, you know, they're not just going to go all out, be like, hey, you know, especially if that's something that's really sensitive, it may take some time for them to warm up. And because I think, Tony, you can attest to this, and they may take some time. It's like, man, I don't know if I want to talk to this person. Like, should I, this may not be the right person for me. They might switch providers. You know, whatever the case is, it may take a little, you know, for most people, I would say, not everyone, because some, they could just come right out and share everything. But I think for most folks, depending on how sensitive it is, they may take some time to even share that. So then now, and when they finally sharing the information, and you look on the news, like, oh, man, they just got breached, the safe spot.
Here we go. I could take that on, right? I could tell you, most cyber professionals, even myself included, I had to double dip and check myself. Being vulnerable in Tony's side of defense means a whole different thing to us as vulnerability of this data, right? Being vulnerable, you want to be open, you want to be transparent, you want to tell the truth, you want to get a rapport with your counselor. And I'm telling you, I just recently learned that. But in that vulnerability, like we know as cybersecurity professionals, you can be exploited. The data is vulnerable and exploitable, right? So that data is my transparency that's been exposed. Everything intimate about me just went out the door in your data breach. So even I, as a cybersecurity professional, knowing that and linking that to makes me apprehensive to share, right? Makes me apprehensive. Like, and behind the scenes too, we look at vulnerability different, right? We look at it like, yo, this data is not protected, it's not encrypted, but what is that data? It's everything about me, right? It's everything I just told my therapist, everything I just told my social worker, every session we've had, right? Every trip that we made, every recommendation they made, right? That's the part I think we're dialing into now, that even cybersecurity professionals are apprehensive to share because of that, right? They know, they look at one of these breaches like, hold up, it's not on the care provider. It's on the organization ensuring that information is protected and that it doesn't get leaked. It doesn't get out. It doesn't expose the social worker either, because that's the first person, social engineering, like we said, that they're going to go after to access that data, especially if you're a CISO, let's say, or if you're somebody in this field that may be going to one of these facilities, you know, to cope.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of things that are missed on that side, that people are missing the social ramifications of this and how heavy that can be. And you know, there's a lot of reluctance, I would say, from some people that are practicing. There's generational things. Well, they say, oh, see, that's why we should have just kept using paper, because we could lock it up in the thing. Right. And the only people that have access to it is the people who got a key to the thing. You know, like,
that's true.
I mean, they're just like, you would have to physically break into the building, like, you know, to get these things. And they were just like, this wasn't a problem, you know, like then. And then see, what were you trying to tell you young cats is out here doing, you know, like, so.
We're trying to tell.
It's really hard to argue back and forth, you know what I'm saying? And so, like, these are the days they used to have a big, huge briefcase that they're taking and actually taking physical notes, you know, God forbid if somebody has the briefcase. But, you know, I just feel like it's hard to argue when everything is readily available at your fingertips. It's convenient, obviously. Right. It helps us streamline things, obviously, but it also puts us at a greater risk. And so... and then we have to remember that we're also sharing things between agencies. You know, for example, something is shared in a session, which happens. You know, there are parameters to confidentiality. Okay. If someone is going to physically harm someone in their life, in someone else's life, you know, there's some sort of abuse that's happening, or, you know, alleged, at that point, we have to enter into documenting with another outside organization, usually a government agency, to be able to take action of some sort, to be able to protect people, physically protect people. And so that happens a lot, actually. And so, and unfortunately, that does affect the therapeutic relationship as well, because that's further exposure. And as you're transitioning information from one organization to another, that opens up a whole nother opportunity of how are they going to handle my private information. Right. And so this private practice may handle it this way. This government organization, like, who has public record and can, you know, be able to have cases that are open and public that can be searched. Like, you know, like that is a whole nother like world. And so, of course, before we enter into the space, we do emphasize the limits to confidentiality. But the thing is that after it leaves our space, we have no control of how that information is being used. Okay. And so in that government agency, if they decide to move forward with a public suit, we also have no control like over how that information is being used. And so it one thing leads to another, leads to another, and then also has social ramifications of now there's a break of a relationship, a therapeutic relationship or a practitioner relationship. And so it happens.
Right. So as we look into the second article here, the title "Technology and Social Work: Opportunities and Challenges," this is coming out of Yeshiva. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeshiva University. This is dated back 16 August 2023. Hold on, man.
My light fell. Okay? I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm okay. My light fell. So sorry. Let me just fix my light. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm fine.
All right, man.
Let's keep it rolling.
I'm checking on you.
Yeah. I mean, like you're in a fight.
No, my light fell. I'm so sorry.
I'm legally required to protect you, Al. Yeah.
Oh,
okay?
I appreciate it. Yes. No, like right. Technical difficulties. Sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. I just make sure you're all right. Make sure you can finish the show. Yeah, so just looking at a quick excerpt from this, because I think this does, like, it's still part of the tone that we're talking about here. So technology is part of all of our everyday lives, both in work and in our free time, phones, computers, tablets, e-readers, watches, kitchen appliances, cars, etc. The list goes on. In social work specifically, there are a lot of ways in which technology allows workers to access and innovative tools that enhance their services and improve their overall efficiency. This unlocks new potential, but at the same time poses some challenges that haven't been seen before or are actively evolving. So I'll start right there. And Tony, just going back where you were saying that, yes, these things are.
Give me a second. Sorry.
Happy anniversary, Al.
Right. Oh, man. Don't worry, we'll edit this part out.
Checking your skills.
Yeah, this is a testament right now.
Al, we can still hear you even though we can't see you.
I know. This is a testament to, I'm purposely leaving audio on because it was so loud. I don't understand why it was so dang on loud. Yeah, so I'm going to finish this desk today too.
If you needed a laugh.
All right,
let's see. Now I pinned it down. I'm definitely getting my lights and stuff sorted.
If you ever need a sign, that was it. Well, like, stop messing around.
So I heard it, and it's not even that big to sound that loud. Like, why was it so loud?
That's your good microphone.
Right.
Right.
You should leave this in so they can further emphasize like our GoFundMe for Al at the end. So
we'll put it in the blooper reel. Yeah, we'll definitely have. Yeah, we'll definitely put that out there.
Oh my gosh!
But yeah, let's pick up with the innovation.
But yeah. So no, I was saying. Well, just kind of piggyback on what you said, Tony, is that yes, having these tools are convenient, but it does come at a cost of security. You know, so yes, being able to have like virtual records of sure, like you have programs. I could even attest to going back to even within the VA veterans hospitals. I don't know why the name is blanking, but I know they have virtual care programs. I'm blanking on the actual term they have. Telehealth. Sorry, just telehealth. Kidding. Telehealth. Nice. There you go. Yeah. So yeah. So but yes, being able to have appointments with patients that, you know, for maybe for some reason they can't make it out there physically to the hospital, you know, maybe elderly, you know, it could be impaired, you know, whatever the case is, that's an option for patients, and it helps the providers to keep in contact with their patients and maintain those, you know, those regular appointments. But as you said, like having these tools, these innovative different tools and methods, they do come at a cost of security, because yeah, if there was a breach to happen now and those records or that data in transit is compromised, you know, it's also not, of course, it's putting the patient at risk and also even the provider for whatever information that was being shared back and forth. So I guess, Tony, I guess if you just want to touch on that, like,
for sure,
is there a bit of Or do you see like a maybe within the office? Like, do you see like a maybe like the old school, new school? Like, I do it this way. You know, I always do it this way. But I don't mess with the internet. You know, right. I keep my old school methods. But do you see that type of clash?
Yes, and with good reason. With good reason, I would say, because whenever there's a shift, there needs to be education around it. Like, not just an overview, like a full education around it. And so, yes, we were able to access people who we otherwise wouldn't have been able to access, you know, using technology. Mm-hmm. And so even when people were ill, especially during COVID-19 pandemic, those folks otherwise would not have been able to be seen, because it was putting us at physical health risk for us to see them in person. But we can still see them, like, virtually, even if they're ill. And so, because then that takes away that level of risk. But the thing is that you have to think about the other parameters. What space are you using? Is this shared space? Can other people hear you? Can other people see your screen? Those things are the things that need to be taught about. And that's why when you get the, you know, back and forth, and sometimes it is also like people who are younger or older don't necessarily have a preference based on the line of generation. Sometimes it's just the fact that, do they have a space that's comparable for them to be able to provide the same level of privacy? And so I know for sure, you know, when I'm teaching but I'm teaching in an apartment, you know, that I know that there's going to be, you know, that's always when the guy comes and cuts the grass. Like, it's always when so clearly there's sound that's being transferred. Well, what if you are a therapist in that home? If someone can, if you can hear the person cutting the grass outside, that means if somebody is walking outside, they can also hear you. There's all these other factors that you have to think about as well. The reason of why we often say yes, you know, or, you know, anyone who prefers in person, is because we can control our own space. We can control the space that we've already created for the professional reason of making sure that there's privacy here. And so now we can't control a space that is at a home or in public or in a car or something like that. And so that can easily be infiltrated. And the thing is that some things are done unknowingly. And so that, you know, we're trying to figure out, how does this, you know, it's not always something that is a breach, like electronically. Sometimes it is an earshot away. And so, and you have to really think about those things and put more thought into your surroundings.
So with that, and our friends, I think you probably appreciate this. So I wonder if there should be like maybe regulations for providers that are doing like remote care, as you mentioned, worrying about, you know, as they're speaking with their patient, and, you know, that sound's traveling outside of the, you know, those four walls of, you know, the house or apartment or what have you, for people who, you know, could be passing by who shouldn't be hearing that. Do you feel like there should be, you know, like our friends, we have like, you know, we have SCIFs, you know, certain areas that, you know, when we talk about like classified information, you have to be inside that SCIF, that because it's been retrofitted, it's designed to make sure that information stays within that specific room.
We also have a NASH, and that's something I'm going to talk about later, where you use the technology to block out particular sounds, or you use the technology, when this is getting a little Skynet-ish, but if somebody walks by, they're blurred and the sound cuts, right? They have technology, like, we just knocking on Zoom's door, right? Like, they have all the stuff to do the background and thing, but the minute I detect a person in this proximity, safe space digitally, sound and audio cut, that screen blocks, right? What I'm saying, it might be obfuscated, right? Because you're right, that place is infiltrated. Tony knocked the ball at the park. Even if that person's cutting grass, you know, it's the shoulder. Remember how we do the don't look over the shoulder? Well, don't look over the digital room now. Don't look over, right. Don't, you know, somebody, if I can see they're cutting grass, regardless if they look like they're cutting grass, block that out. Block that whole, you know, person and the conversation out audibly. Like, we have sound cancellation, but I think we could do a better job as cybersecurity professionals talking to organizations to stand up that type of regulation, right? Because it's not going to be the social workers that's going to know that this technology is available, and this is an intimate on, you know, on detection, do this thing, right? On detection, cut the audio. On detection, block the screen, right? That those telehealth workers and those telehealth solutions like Zoom, and I'm picking on them, but all of the remote room-based things aren't doing that today. So that should be a regulation to set up to give them that digital security, especially the social workers, right?
Yeah, I agree. There's definitely a room for consultant work in that space, for sure. With all of the many hats that social workers wear, having knowledge of things that we would otherwise never know about these things even existing. Like, there's always a room there. There's private practices that literally could be a singular person that has now created an LLC that is seeing people that would never know these things and have right. access to it. They're not being overseen by a larger organization. They are a company of one. And so, like, to be able to say, like, there's quote unquote best practices out there would be to really, like, lean into the continuing education requirements and leading into the accrediting bodies like the CSWE, the Council for Social Work Education, to be able to say, like, when your students are taking interviewing class or when they're taking, you know, groups where they're learning how to work with clients one-on-one or they're learning how to work in groups, like, to teach them about these different levels of technology that is included in our education, because those are our beginning social workers. This is before they even get released out and to be able to be independent practitioners and clinicians is the education side. So the CSWE having a handle on that side. And then the National Association of Social Work, which is NASOL, like, for them to be able to say, like, if you want to be a NASOL member or if you want to continue your membership, like, you'll need to make sure that you, you know, go through this. I know as an educator, the educational, like, institutions, some of them have streamlined requirements, like, for us to go through, like, phishing training and all these different things. And so, like, actually, we actually had someone try, you know, here at the university at Middle Tennessee, like, to send an email saying, hey, can you please send me a text message? Like, this is my number. Send me your text, like, whatever. And it was looking like it was coming from a leader, like a dean or whatever. And some people actually sent, you know, their information. And so, of course, well, you know, because I remember my training. Let me look at the email address. That doesn't say at mtsu.edu. Like, that doesn't say whatever, whatever. I know his email address. Let me check and see if this is the same email address. It's not. So then, but what did I do? I reported it to phishing. And I also sent an email to the dean saying, somebody is using your thing. Like, I just want to let you know, like, I took a screenshot of it so you can see what it looks like. Is anybody, you know? But the thing is that, that's because I'm attached to an educational institution that required for me to take that training. That's not because I'm a social worker out practicing, you know, as a practitioner, as a clinician. And so, like, because I'm a therapist, because I'm an educator and I'm a social worker, I have all these different means to be able to collect this information. But if I'm just a social worker that's practicing every day or a clinician that's seeing clients, how would that education be disseminated down to those social workers?
You come on the Cyber Coffee Hour and we hash it out. So I do have a question, Tony, right here, because you got me. Now you got the wheels turning. We go back a little bit as far as the electronic health record. Does your industry give you a secure digital space and physical space? I kind of try to explain, like Joseph said, Dr. Joseph said, a SCIF exists in a particular realm we're not going to touch on right now. But is there a place that you as a practitioner can go in and you have a secure means of talking, a secure means of digitally picking up the phone? That phone is secured by your organization, and that electronic telepresence is known to be secure. Do they train y'all in the tools that y'all use being secure and private?
So when you say, did they, it depends on who the they is. And so my contract has now, like, ended as a therapist at the specific practice that I was practicing at temporarily, because I'm focusing now on finishing my dissertation. But like, that independent, like, practice, like, uses a platform that has, like, these different encrypted things and everything like that. But we did not have a phone. Like, that was, you know, I don't know what the things that are all the things, you know? So right. Like, but we don't have, you know, so, but like, if people are contacting us, we had secured email. you know, like to be able to, you know, that we only were supposed to like contact via secured email, you know. But the thing is that it goes back to what I was saying before, where if they would, depending on where they found me, you know, if they saw me on Psychology Today and they Googled me and my LinkedIn came up and they sent me a private message, right, then it's like,
it's the outside.
I have no control over how you have access to me. I have no control over how you initiate like the communication. Now I can try to shepherd them back into like, you know, please email me in this space or whatever. But being out in the community, when you're giving a talk, you say, oh, I'm a therapist at this practice, and you know, whatever, I'm under contract for this amount of time, this and that. They say, okay. And they just usually just Google your name or whatever. Like, people hardly even exchange business cards anymore. I do have an electronic like business card where people can like scan QR code or whatever, but people still do the search and they just access you however they want to access you. And so depending on your organization and how that organization is structured would determine what kind of resources that you have. If you're at a private practice that has one person at it and you're now person number two, you know, they might not have those things. And the thing is that neither one of us are sitting in that space all day. Like, we have another job, we have another whatever. And so it's, we don't have any way to guarantee like how the different ways that people access us. If you're working for an organization that a larger organization, I'm sure they have those SOPs and streamlined or whatever, but there's a lot of social workers out here that are working for themselves. And so that are working in a community-based space, or where people are literally walking up to them and, you know, and saying, aren't you a social worker? And then they start telling their life story. And so, you know, it's a lot of, you know, different things. I feel like I have a sign on me that's like, I'm in Walmart. Like, I was just trying to, you know, I knew I shouldn't have got this cereal. I should have just went this way. You know, like, so, because someone will find
you. Is the cereal a preference that triggered the conversation?
Look, like, that would be, I felt something like, else. I was like, did my trainer send you over here? I'm not supposed to be in the cereal aisle, you know. So, but this—that's the thing. But I'm looking behind my shoulder and saying, okay, we can't have that conversation right here. Like, there's only so many ways that you can protect people when you literally work person to person with people. And so, and with the way that you do that can vary. You know, with a student, my classroom is recorded, and so after class, you know, if there's still time left, like in my timed session, you know, I usually go straight to the end, which I'm sure the students, I'll see that on my TVAL later. But like, if there's any time left at the end and that class is still recording and they say, they start talking about a personal issue, it's recorded into the end of that recording of my classroom. And so there's all these different things that you have to say. So last semester, I didn't have any of my classes that were recorded available to the students. And so, and there were also, the students didn't realize that even a whisper, like, this is a brand new building, so I'm very fortunate. But so, but there's a whisper that they're capturing, little comments that are being said, you know, whether you're saying about another classmate or about me, and I can hear it because the mics are all in the ceiling.
Yeah,
you know, like all the little details and things that you have to always be thinking about. And so I know that there are other educators that likely use these classrooms that have the whole class where that's recorded, just put it up. It automatically goes into the cloud. And then anybody can hear anything that was said in that space. And so I am very, you know, protective. I'm very protective of everyone that I have contact with. And I'm always thinking about, let me make sure that, you know, this is okay. And I know some of the students are like, you know, she just wants us to come to class. That's why she won't put up the recordings. But I'm just like, well, yes. But also,
I'd probably be one of those students as a technologist person. Like, why can't I have the recording?
Like, they already know, like, the whole room is being recorded. Why won't you just, you know? But, and could I go back and edit and do all, but that is not, that's not what I do here.
Yeah.
And so come to class. But also, thinking about the things that are said that are private, if you whispered something to someone, you didn't expect for your professor to hear that. If you whispered something about someone, you definitely didn't expect that someone to hear that. And so, like, I know that it there's layers on layers on layers, but you have to be a little bit more intentional about that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, can we dive back into something real quick, Joseph? We said something about the facility, but I see in the article it says it get there's a help overcoming phobia in certain facilities. It's called agoraphobia. Now, I didn't know what that was before this episode, but
Can you say it again?
Is it called agoraphobia?
Are you talking about agoraphobia?
Agoraphobia. See, thank you. I didn't know how to say it.
Agoraphobia. There may be another thing. I don't know. Yeah,
maybe it's something in the back of my brain too, but it's the overcoming communication barrier, right? Like some of these folks, like we just said earlier, may not be, they've gone to different facilities. They've had different practitioners. They know the electronic health record of choice for that particular practitioner, and they may have been exposed to one of these situations you mentioned. Hey, I said something to my practitioner, but I didn't want that out there, right? Can you speak to that? And can you speak to what you said before? Are some of these practitioners, the facilities, using the same electronic health record systems in your profession? Or do they vary? Are they dissimilar in sharing? They vary a lot. Okay.
Yeah, they vary. I mean, there's a number of large like platforms, you know, I'm not sponsored by any of them, you know, but I would say there's ones that particularly have a massive amount of the market, you know, like Simple Practice or whatever. Like there's a lot of organizations and companies that are huge that do these things that are case management, like records or, you know, therapy note records, you know, that have a big part of the market. And so, yeah, for sure. And there's also, like you said, the space, like when someone is afraid of a specific space, you know, having a client that's afraid of hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, if your space is in a hospital, you know,
that
they may have good reason.
Yeah.
And that may be something that you can work through. But if your protected private space is in a hospital, then you have to think about how do I meet the need and not reintroduce my client into something that affects them very deeply. And so you have to also remember, these things are very real. Okay. This is not imaginary things. Anything that makes you feel something is real. That's real. And so whether it's tangible or visible or auditory or not, if it causes you to have biofeedback, you know, you have a biological response, then it's very real. And it's your responsibility as a professional to be able to pay close attention to that. But then you often, what other space do you have available?
So say it again, it's called biofeedback. That's can you explain that? I'm sorry, Tony. Can you explain
biofeedback? Yeah, when you have a biological response to something. For example, you know, you can say something, I don't like that because it makes me, you know, nauseous. The smell of something, you know, the smell of someone's cologne may bring back a memory and that make your hands start to sweat. That is a biofeedback. You know, your heart rate starts to increase. That means that your body is giving you feedback of something that is happening, you know? And so there's some stimulus somewhere that is providing something that is causing you a physical biological response. And so, and you definitely, if possible, try your best to make sure that you are able to acknowledge, affirm, and protect your client from having unnecessary responses that are within your control. And so there's some things that you can't control. You can't control where you work sometimes.
Right.
And so if you're working for a large organization or agency that has policies that you have to stay within, you have to think about that. Now, the social workers that are probably going to watch this are going to be like, you know, that we kind of bend and slide and kind of find ways around
too. They're going to think I might have a biofeedback to a particular system.
Yeah, like you might have something and be like, or you see something on screen, be like, oh, please, not that, please, no.
Right.
And
so, not or another data breach.
Yeah, you see something or you see someone that's handling something that you don't trust them.
Right.
Exactly. Then that may immediately make you have a response, or you're like, I don't think that that person is going to be able to handle it at the level of care that needs to be handled. We all have these situations, no matter what like field that you practice in. And so the thing is that you have to remember there's also something called countertransference. And so, which means that like your client may be transferring something onto you, but when you have countertransference, that means it's going the opposite direction as well. And so you're in
that's
a space.
Why we're having this episode, Tony. That's why we're having this episode. You're schooling us like crazy right now. Like,
look, I'm happy that I can do this. You know, it's Social Work Month. Here we are. And right, so like, right. I feel like it's important also to realize that you have to be in a space that you feel comfortable practicing too. Nice. And so that you're able to be able to give the services at your highest level to the client that you're providing services for. And so they say, well, I really would like to meet in a coffee shop. Okay, well, if you had something significant happen to you at a coffee shop and you personally as a practitioner are like, I don't feel comfortable with that. Or the smell of coffee may bring back some sort of, you know, like memory or whatever. You can say, well, I know that that's your preference, but let's try to find a middle ground of something that, you know, would work. Because the thing is, as when you're working out in the, when you're working out in the community, especially when you're working with people who are unhoused, your space is limited.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. And so you can't assume that everyone has transportation, that everyone has the ability to meet you in another space, or everyone even has technology to make a phone call. If you don't have a phone, you don't have a home, you don't have a plug to plug anything into.
You may not even have internet.
You don't have internet access. You don't have, or if you go into a space where you would, they shoo you away because they see your physical outside appearance. And so like they're utilizing spaces that are public, like libraries. Libraries are havens for people who are unhoused.
Outer havens, right? Those are my favorite places.
They are. And so, but the thing is that if I want to meet a client in a library that is a public space, and though they have study rooms and though they have whatever, those walls are thin. And so no shade to the library. But I really like have to realize that I also have to do my job. And if this is where this person feels safe, just because they're unhoused doesn't mean that they trust me. As a matter of fact, it's usually the opposite case. And so you also have to realize, how do you build rapport with something or meet someone when you have no idea where they will be? They have no watch, they have no phone, they have no address. And so there's all these different things we have to also remember, that our levels of privilege come into play. You know, where you're working with people that may not have the level of resources or the ability to have more privacy things, or we don't have the budget to be able to have additional things and soundproofing and all these other things that would be awesome and great for the clients and be in their best interest. But let's keep it real. Okay. And so these are social work organizations. Okay. You know, we're not attorneys or medical doctors unless you decided to go get another degree. And so, like, I really need to emphasize this, that is limited resources on both sides when it comes to social workers as we're practicing and when it comes to our clients and the circumstances that they may be in.
Right. And now, as we look to
wrap this up, we look at the different challenges when looking at challenges of technology within social work. So, two major components, you look at ethical and also, of course, the cybersecurity aspect. So looking at ethical issues, we look at digital ethics, informed consent challenges, and privacy and confidentiality concerns. We're talking about HIPAA and things of that nature. When we're looking at the cybersecurity side of it, we look at the integral role of digital technology, the potential for cyber threats. You're pretty much introducing that anytime we're making those paper or physical records digital now, you do introduce those cyber threats. And also, again, the HIPAA compliance, you know, how are you handling those digital documents? How is it being transferred? As you mentioned, are you having those conversations within the defined, confines, whether it's within office space or whatnot? You know, if you talk about something that, you know, you're having that phone, you know, maybe having a phone call, but it's not on a secure line. Hey, we can't talk about this on this line. We got to make sure we're on a secure line. So those are those cybersecurity concerns, even with email. If you're talking about, you know, how you even share anything online, like, hey, do not share this, you know, via email. It needs to be through the hospital website, because they may have a secure means of how you transfer, you know, that data or information between a provider and patient.
Or being informed to know that they may not, and to not use, you know, to encourage them to have the right ethics and encrypt those communications. Everything Tony described has to be handled specifically and ethically digitally. There needs to be a training on how to do that, and know the facilities that have also provided that safe digital transfer of all the case notes Tony just provided us.
No, this is good. And I think this is always going to be a, you know, concern you know, I think social work is going to, you know, heavily relies on technology, cybersecurity, especially. I mean, as our friends, I was just mentioned, you know, just with, like I said, with UnitedHealthcare, other hospitals, as they, you know, maintain or house or stewards of our patient data, they're gonna be targets for cyber criminals because they know they're gonna pay, and they're gonna pay quick because they can't afford to be, you know, in a wrestling match with a cyber criminal, you know, over the data. Like, look, just give me the data, I pay whatever, so I just make sure I keep this patient alive. You know, whatever the case is. So I'm very interested to see, you know, how this progresses, and maybe there's better ways to protect patient data going forward.